about how they can help make this film and spread the word. Thanks very much indeed.
It's linked on our website. And Ronnie Kosrolls, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it immensely.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half in just a moment. That's a person, you know, that I've read about and been familiar with for many years. So that was it's fascinating. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Only on a show like this could I be receiving IMs while I talk to really a objectively historical figure complaining that I did not do my right-wing Mandela impression to him. I think that really distills the polls of this show, that we could have a 40-minute conversation with a former movement leader of the armed struggle to liberate South Africa, who then served as a minister of intelligence and a deputy defense secretary. And there's also another part of the show where I do an impression of one of the greatest icons of the 20th century, as essentially a like right-wing pop-up ad come to life. Those are the polls of this program. And you're not going to find it many other places.
Yes, folks. Irony being, by the end of Michael's life, he was in a lot of places. TMBS, Jacobin, ITV. But when he's saying that show, that's the polls of Michael. Like, nobody could do what he was doing there. Sad day today. I'm going to mute this music now.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's tough. It snuck up on me this year. But I got to say that I'm very happy to be sitting here with you right now, even though it was virtually, and all of the lovely people who make up this great community has meant so much over the past couple of years, not going through this, you know, solo. And like, I wanted to say something about the 2-year milestone for me. I remember like, because there was such an amazing and just really surprising and welcome, like outpouring of support after Michael immediately passed away. And I remember thinking to myself, though, that, like, you know, you got to be careful not to, like, use this as too much of a crutch, because one day it's going to be a year, and then one day it was going to be 2 years, and, you know, this day will just sort of pass along. And it just means so much, and it's a testament to the amount of people that he's touched and the, you know, community that he's built, that it's 2 years later, and it still hits just as hard, and there's just as many people who are feeling that collectively, and I just feel really blessed for that. I want to say that a bit, Tom.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it's funny, that anxiety of, is this healthy? But I to me, it seems good. I'm addicted to hearing different people say, like, Michael saved me from Sam Harris, or Michael saved me from Jordan Peterson, or this or that. Like, that sort of stuff is as gratifying as you get in this business, frankly. I mean, until, like, we achieve, like, Medicare for All or something like that, then all your individual stories can get lost. But yeah, and today has been another one of that, where my DMs are full of people, you know, just commenting on him going out of his way to, you know, reach out to them and engage them in a deeper way than is typical. And it sucks. You know, you're an older brother, right, David? You don't have any older siblings?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, me too. And I think for us older brothers, there's maybe a difficulty, because we don't have that close, that older sibling to sort of mediate the world. And so, like, finding those figures, I've often, like, as I get older, I realize, like, it's there might be a barrier for that. And Michael was absolutely, like, an intellectual older brother. He's like a sort of backstop. I remember when Joe Rogan was getting into the white genocide stuff, and just, you know, I played that Ronnie Kosrolls clip. Michael's depth of knowledge was just so impressive. And it was also not intimidating. It wasn't like somebody who was your superior. He was your peer.
It wasn't intimidating. But I was driving my truck around earlier today, and I was thinking, I just had like a flashback to a memory. It was when I first like met him. And him saying something to me that just sort of stuck with me. I can't remember what we were talking about, but I was saying, oh, I just finished this book. And he goes, man, I don't think I've finished a book in 5 years, which is like, I think what is probably a lie, because, you know, he was somebody who was very well read and like knew so much about the world. But like saying something like that, I don't know, like it eased the tension in the room where it's like Michael could sometimes come off as somebody who was like just, you know, hitting the books the second he was off camera. And he certainly was doing that. But I don't know. He wasn't like he'd never lorded stuff over people or made you feel like less than. But again, like at that moment too, I didn't really know him too well. And now that I look back and think about it, I was like, that was an absolutely wild thing for him to say to me.
Yeah. At that point. Right. It's like, no, I've only scanned like 40 and like the, like for all week. The most important bits. Yeah.
But y'all, we have a pretty fun show planned for y'all. We're going to be talking a lot about Michael today, as y'all could imagine. We're going to look at some clips and sort of break down one of a personal favorite of mine of the commentaries that we put together for TMBS, a couple other fun things. Then we're going to be joined by Jason Miles. This is Revolution to talk about one of his most recent video essays on why we don't need any more heroes. And before you think that he's talking about something else, it's a very, very strong video that ends with a great clip of Michael. Can't wait to share that with all of y'all. And I figured, since we're doing a little bit of, you know, remembering today and throwbacks, that we'd re-up the gem at the end of the show too. We're going to be talking about fintech and some of the things there. And then later in the evening at 8:30 Central for our patrons, patreon.com/leftforreckoning to get access, we're going to be joined by a rogues gallery? No, a good group of fellows. Danny Bessner, Gene Bajelon, Ben Burgess, Wozni Lombre, and Nando Villa to do a cheers to Michael. So I really hope that people can join us for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, we have some funny stuff that we want to get to. But, you know, I mean, like, to shout out Woz, I think, had like one of the best little taglines for what Michael's work was, and particularly what TMBS was, is that, you know, like the impressions and the comedy, that's like what brought you in. But then you get inside and then we feed you brain food. And, you know, so much of Michael's work was like trying to find a way to make the show, one, extremely entertaining and, you know, a joy to participate in, and I imagine a lot of fun to listen to as well. But also, like, there was a rigor and an attempt to try to build a different kind of left, a different kind of movement, and sort of break through particularly some of these habits that people develop just generally by being an American, I would say, but particularly coming out of maybe like liberalism, philosophies of politics that very much center around the individual versus the collective. And, you know, it was, I mean, I know you experienced this too, like working with Michael was such a treat, because like we'd be fucking around for like an hour and a half, right before the show, would go live and tell him dirty jokes and things like that. And then 10 minutes before it's like, all right, business, boom. And we're going to talk about, you know, Lula da Silva or Evo Morales, or something like what we're about to play here. The difference between sympathy and solidarity. And you know what? I think rather than belabor it, let's just get to it. It's a bit of a longer one because I just didn't think this was one that was worth cutting up. And I think that that's something that's very true of a lot of Michael's work, is that like there's great sound bites. But
I don't want to cut into too much, but like especially towards the latter couple of years, Michael was putting it together. And you saw mm-hmm. like in the clip with like where he's going off in front of Cornel West, somebody he like absolutely grew up idolizing, and he's able to speak. I mean, I was always super impressed by his ITV appearances too. Like he was really, we've both been with Michael and Suya trying to record things and taking takes and stuff like that. And seeing him on like his less sure side, but yeah, he was really putting it together. And I think this is a good example of that.
Certainly was. So here we go, y'all.
So we need a politics that centers democracy and the commons and is built on true broad-based social bonds. And in order to understand some of the different sentiments at place, we need to talk about the difference between sympathy and solidarity. Having sympathy with working people is important, but it's not the same as people having solidarity with one another. In fact, the theorist, the father of capitalism himself, Adam Smith, claimed that the tendency to admire rich people and despise the poor is the great and universal cause of corruption of our moral sentiments. He understood the moral difference here. He was actually quite persuasive in his moral condemnations of certain types of obscene wealth, even as he obviously was a promoter with massive blind spots around capitalism. In our society, we often demonize poor and working class people and then confuse a sympathy, which runs counter to that demonization, with actual solidarity. Our politics need to be built on solidarity. It's not about pity. In Buddhism, there's actually a brilliant teaching on what's called the near enemies. And these are desirable states that are confused with undesirable states. So as an example, one is equanimity with indifference. Dealing with crisis and seeing things in life and in the world and dealing with it with some measure of equanimity is great. Having indifference to it is not. Some people confuse that. And they also talk specifically about confusing compassion with pity. Pity is separating yourself from the action. It's fundamentally condescending. It's fundamental distinction making. It is not, we're actually in this together in, as an example, a shared class struggle against the capital class. Solidarity means empowering people to win power and write their own rules. Fundamentally, a politics of solidarity is about a belief in people, in your community and outside of your community. It's a belief in the possibility that we can come together and build a genuinely democratic world in all spheres, including the economic one. Building solidarity is not just a question of sympathy. It's something the left has struggled to do. Too many in the left aren't willing to do that work. The working class is diverse and dynamic. They aren't going to come prepackaged sharing all of your beliefs, cultural prejudices, and social practices. Solidarity is sharing community with people who, by definition, are not the same as you in every category. Lula was able to build a politics of solidarity and a diverse working class movement in Brazil, which he is reassembling today. And I want to just play some of this clip because it's relevant tonally and it's also inspiring. Lula is in fact out of prison. And even as Bolsonaro continues to run through wrecking Brazil, destroying the Amazon, pushing through a militant neoliberal and neo-fascistic agenda, the social movements, the leadership, the bottom-up, and a leader that leads from solidarity is out there. And remember, this is President Lula before he voluntarily turned himself in for an unjust, corrupt political imprisonment, rallying his supporters. And he was right.
Oh. Eu falei para os companheiros, se dependesse da minha vontade, eu não iria, mas eu vou. Eu vou porque eles vão dizer a partir da manhã que o Lula está foragido, que o Lula está escondido. Não, eu não estou escondido. Eu vou lá na barba deles para eles saberem que eu não tenho medo, para eles saberem que eu não vou correr e para eles saberem que eu vou provar a minha inocência. Eu vou terminar com uma frase que eu peguei em 1982 numa menina de 10 anos em Catanduva, que eu não sei quem é. E essa frase não tem autor. A frase dizia: os poderosos podem matar uma, duas ou três rosas, mas jamais conseguirão deter a chegada da primavera. E a nossa luta é em busca da primavera.
I also love that Celso Amorim, who's been on this show, is right there, right behind him. People need to understand Gramsci's concept of the organic intellectual, which is really, in some ways, just a reaffirmation of the notion that, which, again, is all too often totally missing from liberal circles in America, and, of course, always under onslaught and con artistry and war from the right wing, which is that working class people can understand and contextualize their own circumstances. It is not just wrong for people to not understand that. It's fundamentally condescending. and it does not create the necessary politics of solidarity. Gramsci rejected this, and also crucially, the idea that the working class was incapable of producing their own intellectuals. The job of the left is to promote and empower members of different groups to produce their own intellectuals and leaders capable of organizing their class against capital hegemony. This is a project only a politics of solidarity can create, and a politics of PMC sympathy outright rejects. Gramsci wrote, "I'm a pessimist because of intelligence, but an optimist because of will. We need to build a movement that can handle the contradictions and confusions of the modern world, steeped in the intellectual traditions that can bring us the necessary clarity, but to also build a world that is based that also is need-based on politics, on an unshakable optimism of will. This will only come from the community of solidarity and the interconnected movement that it can build. Sympathy can be a great starting point, but solidarity is the goal."
I mean, there's a lot to go in there, but I do have to note that I was going to make a point at the end of it that I believe there's three people on that stage who ended up being on TMBS, and Michael Beebe to the punch there, giving that shout out to Celso Amorim, and obviously Lula and Hidaji. But yeah, I mean, I think maybe let's re-up the point before we maybe talk about some of the things there. It's like, I think that this really shows like what that project, especially towards the end, was becoming about. Was, you know, hard, serious political analysis, a lot of fun building community and sociability, but also really trying to move people from the position that a lot of like liberals and hippies and all of, you know, the good old freaks who we all are part of and love to death, have sort of fallen into, those traps that they've fallen into, where it's like, you know, you care very deeply about things that are happening to other people and the rest of the world. And that undoubtedly is like a precondition. But that's muted compared to what solidarity is, which is an actual project of doing something about it. And I think that like we, you know, and Michael especially, like really walked that line of having like the moral outrage and the motivation to do something about this on that level, but also realizing that, you know, we can feel however we want about the world. The point is to start to build up those movements that can change them. And in particular, like at that moment, that was such in American politics, at least, such a clear distinction between like the Bernie Sanders movement and maybe the Warren progressive movement that we were seeing, was this difference between, you know, politics of sympathy, but that also had a lot of extremely, baked into it negative views of your average working person in this country. And what Michael was trying to promote there, which was recognizing that people understand their circumstances. And what we need to do as a left is to build vehicles and outlets so that something can be done about it, rather than just sort of preaching endlessly to people to like wake up or, you know, whatever, like a lot of that movement ended up doing.
Yeah.
I'll also say that, like, you know, working with Michael on a lot of those things was such a delight, because like the way that a lot of those segments sort of would work out is like he'd call me up ideally on Sunday, but usually Monday night, the day before the show. And we would just talk for like 40 minutes on whatever, and who knows what sparked that conversation between us. And then I would take, you know, what we were sort of getting out of that conversation and write it down in bullet points and maybe put a turn of phrase on it. And like, if anyone else were to see those and like try to use them, they couldn't. Like Michael was just so quick and so good that like I could just give, like I could literally be like, you know, Lula solidarity on the sheet. And he was 2 minutes on that, you know, like,
yeah.
it was such a treat really working with him, because having sort of set the idea beforehand, he was ready to go already. And it was fun. I mean, there's other ones out there that they do sort of crack me up, because we didn't always do those that sort of develop later, where you can see Michael like reading something on the sheet and then like disagreeing with it, like reading the first sentence and then cutting, yeah. Which always, you know, broke my heart a little bit. But I love that one, because that one was like from conception to delivery, I think, was exactly what we were trying to say. And also, like, one last thing that I'll note too is like why like Michael was such an incredible figure and a great intellect was like, think about what goes into that argument that he's making there, right? Practical experiences in American politics that are happening, Lula's experience, and then who's being cited? Adam Smith, right? Like the ideological.
Well, I was going to ask David, was that your contribution or was that Michael's?
That was for me from Luke, but I'm, you know, Michael was very familiar with it. Right. You know, to adding like the Buddhism, and then that's ending Michael. With the Gramsci. Yeah. But like, right. You know, and the thing was with Michael is that like, you know, he wasn't dogmatic. Mm-hmm. He wasn't an ideologue, but I would also really reject anybody who called him eclectic as a thinker. And what I mean by that, maybe this is like more dogmatic Marxism for some folks, like eclecticism can sort of be a bad word because, you know, you're pulling from things from different like viewpoints and they really don't align. But, you know, Michael was very much rooted in a kind of Marxist socialist theory, but throughout his life, he had absorbed so many different ideas. And if anything, like was able to use all those ideas, if not to inspire like the actual content of his work, but really as reference point, because like that Buddhism conception right there is so critical to that argument, right? It's something I wouldn't have imported in there. And like it really rings true, which just shows like why like having that kind of appetite for learning about the world, and obviously these are his life experiences that expose him in particular, like Buddhism and stuff, really just made him so great at communicating to folks, because that hits with somebody who might have grown up in a community where they were being exposed to Buddhism, or to somebody who it's a very, very foreign concept other than a statue you see every once in a while, right? And like he was able to draw on all these things and include everybody in them, which I think is just a real model that, you know, people who might do this or want to communicate publicly in some way really can learn a lot from.
And he did that so widely, right? Like, I mean, it was a different sort of fluency of his that attracted Waz to him with like the Nation of Islam jokes and stuff like that, right? Like, and I think that's like what's, it's a feature of honestly the way we are able to communicate now, where you can reach a vast number of people. It's not based on like frequency and what your airspace has, you know, capability to hold. It's on topics, and that is a pretty amazing thing. Like, you know, Gutenberg was pretty good, but this what we're doing here is different. And like Bhaskar said today at Majority Report, like it's weird how, or it's not weird. It's like kind of a bit heartening the permanence, or I don't want to say permanence, but like the lastingness. Michael can be going viral, being tweeted out by Gigi or Bella Hadid, I'm not sure which one, but like when there's shit going on in Israel, Palestine, and like that, I mean, I'm not sure, like that, I think like he understood that, right? Like that's why I like the clip at the cold open, is like he understood the Kaz roles, like he got an opportunity to talk to somebody he's read about and like, and really like, and somebody people need to be aware of, like the South African apartheid, especially the armed struggle against it. That's a submerged part of the even like anti-apartheid history in South Africa. And like he brought that to a whole bunch of people, and he knew how important that was because it was important to him.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, like South Africa was always a reference point for him. And I think that cold open was a really perfect encapsulation of the work that he was coming. That was his first solo interview too.
Yep.
Just incredible. The guy knew how to like meet the moment. On that, I will just highly suggest to folks, because I know that we experience this sometimes on the program here and certainly experience it on TMBS, that I would really like it if people maybe, you know, once everything's finished up or tomorrow or something, go and watch that interview with Lula, because that was such a historic moment. And, you know, unfortunately, those things don't hit as viral as like a, you know, Dave Rubin debunking thing. But that was like the real work that he was putting out there. And he was so proud of that interview. And it's a phenomenal, phenomenal interview, because he's able to sit with a world leader and have an incredible conversation with him. Lula, in his own, you know, way, really opens up. And I'm just sad that there weren't more opportunities like that, because Michael was so good at that stage. Like the thing that's wild about him when you watch him, like we're going to play a clip in just a second of him on I-24, the Israeli news network that he was always going on. But like he knew how to meet the stage that he was at. Like doing this. You know, he was able to be funny and irreverent and hang out, going speaking at, was it, you know, Bates. Going and speaking at Bates with West and all those folks. Was able to meet that moment, as y'all were talking about, and on MR too, like really inviting people, and even when they're asking him hostile questions, mm-hmm. and then go on to like a kind of stuffy newsroom environment and still like himself, like shine through, hit really good points. I mean, the guy understood the moment that he was in. It's something that I'm still learning from. And I'll be learning from forever. But let's go, because I wanted to make sure that we're getting a little fun stuff in here. And this isn't just a pure comedy thing or a sketch, but these were some of the funniest things that we did. And I loved how like stoked Michael was to share these experiences with us, too.
Because he kicked ass at it. Yeah. like you know, and Michael had been appearing on things for a long time. And like there's certain ones where he's like, yeah, that wasn't my best appearance, like early on in like podcasting. But when he started doing these TV hits, he was just crushing it.
Oh, yeah. And he was ready for them. Yeah. So I don't know how far we'll get into this time-wise, but we could try to get through it. This is a little meta for y'all. This is TMBS replay of I-24 debate that he did, which is like one of these just super fringe right-wing Republican guys. I had to cut it at the beginning, so there's a little crosstalk, but the question and the topic will become clear pretty quick.
That's gentlemen, certainly their role.
Very quickly, a moment ago we mentioned a couple of the congressional freshmen who are going to be involved in the investigation here. Two of whom have made names for themselves lately for some fairly public gaffes in interviews. Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib, whose anti-Israel rhetoric has had...
Journalists like this love the concept of gaffes.
Love it. Love
her
it.
In the spotlight a little bit. So what do you say to critics who would argue that these are just two people just trying to make a name for themselves right now?
Well, I think they're both doing incredible jobs, and I think it's in testament by the sort of complete inability of Republicans to deal with them and the sort of symbolic response. I know that Rashida Tlaib is obviously has a Palestinian background. I think she's going to have a set of concerns about Palestinian human rights. This is people from my own Jewish community. Sorry?
Pause it. Rewind that. Just to be really clear what he just said there, okay?
Holy shit.
So you can see, we've gone the first couple of minutes, and especially because, by the way, they put me on with fucking lunatics. I joke with the bookers. I'm like, oh, so it's me against, like, a guy who, like, escaped from an asylum and wants people to have guns, and, you know, it's like, they don't appreciate those jokes. But they put me on with, I mean, I remember one guy I was on with one time. I was like, you know, I'm not pedantic about using the word fascism, but it was like, oh, this guy is like literally a brown shirt.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, doing like shit that Trump isn't even saying we're going to do on immigration. So far, I'm actually like, yeah, this is just standard, you know, right wing bullshit, whatever. And then this happened.
Response. I know that Rashida Tlaib is obviously has a Palestinian background. I think she's going to have a set of concerns about Palestinian human rights. This is people from my own Jewish community. Sorry?
Who married her brother?
She married her brother? Okay. I haven't heard that one. That sounds like we're off in the Newsmaxosphere. But look, if we want to be serious, we can all come together, I think, to deal with, as an example, over your bureaucracy and the intelligence services.
So
if you're concerned about the border, that's a fake crisis in terms of Mexico. But if you support a coup in Venezuela, and there's legitimate criticisms of all sides here, but if you instigate a civil war type situation in Venezuela, while you're supporting, by the way, a dictatorship in an aspiring dictatorship in Brazil that imprisoned a popular former two-term president.
Oh, my gosh.
These things are going to lead to more border and migration. So let's deal with it by dealing with foreign policy.
I would love to spend more time talking about this. Michael Brooks, John Loudon, we thank you so much for your time.
I'm not sure he would have, but I cucked the crazy guy. So, actually, no, literally, I went out on a date with Gina.
What a stupid, stupid married couple.
If they really are a couple, that is fucking
Jesus
appalling.
Christ.
I hope they have not procreated.
I don't know what that was about.
That's the best.
Oh, man. I mean, that's racism times racism when you – I think it's Rashida Tlaib who's being accused of marrying her brother. I mean, I forgot
about
that.
He's too racist to even get his racist dog whistles right.
Yeah.
But he was, I mean, it was, those were, I loved hearing those stories. you know, I hope it's not talking too much out of class, but just like him telling us about the entire process, like they'd pick him up in a limo and he would just like try to schmooze with the bookers a little bit, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully.
Well, that's how like people like him and like Adam Friedland of Cumtown got like the, I think there's a cool booker at that show.
I think so too. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of those clips up on TMBS as well, but yeah, I mean, he was something else. And, you know, we're going to have a lot of time tonight. Remember, everybody, we're going to be talking a lot more about this in the post game with our guests, a whole host of them. I'll go through the list in a little bit. But, you know, I mean, he really, like, made such a big impact on so many people and on my life. And I'm so grateful for it. And, like, we'll play a fun clip in just a second, but I just want to say that like one thing that really touches me in moments like this, cause you know, like doing this on your own is tough. And it was nice having Michael as our captain.
Oh yeah.
And now, you know, sort of charting off on our own path, Matt and I, like all the time I think about, you know, it's irrational obviously, but like, I'll forget for a second. I'll be like, I need to text Michael for this. It's like, what the, you know, like insane kind of brain stuff. And you know, that's not the point of this, but I realize, sometimes when you watch some of these clips, and also, you know, memories that I have of him, like just interpersonally, that he was always trying to set Matt and I up to prepare us to be able to do something on our own too. Not in this context, obviously, but like it's one of these things, not to intellectualize this too much, but it's a point that we make about like socialist politicians is that, you know, there's two kinds that happen in left movements where like one person sort of gets shot up into the stratosphere and then they realize that, oh, well, if people know how I do this, then they won't have a need for me. So I'm going to keep everything like very secret. And that wasn't the case with Michael. Like he really was like, it was like, you know, a bit of an apprenticeship in a way. Like he was always sort of showing us how to do things and encouraging us in a way that, like, looking back on that, you know, especially knowing not knowing what was going to happen, that was like a really sweet and kind way to look after, you know, your producers, you know, is to prepare, you know, is to not be like, I own you forever, I'm going to keep you down, to always be like, let's try something, you know, like the Gem, for God's sakes, when we launched that, literally that came, Michael and I were sitting at a bar at 1 a.m. and I said, there's not enough left wing guys who do finance stuff. Michael said, let's do it. And I was like, yeah. I'm not ready for that. And I said, yeah, you are. You know, it's just like those kind of moments, like he was a really great person to learn from for all those years.
Yeah. I mean, people still comment super producer on my Instagram, stuff. And that was all Michael. Yeah, it's tough.
Well, let me play this clip. Matt hasn't seen this yet, though he's in it. Because there's no easy way to do this. But in that spirit, let's just play this for a second. It's taking a little bit out of context, but y'all get it quick.
I've been freaked out a little bit in the, you know, when you get paranoid like Elon Musk as to whether we're living in a simulation or not.
Right.
When it comes to how dead on the nose presidential mottos have been in terms of sort of the core problems of those campaigns. So Hillary, you have Ready for Hillary, which encapsulates the sort of bureaucratic climbing nature of it.
And or, the empty just...
Right, just nothing, yeah.
Right, right.
Like, why should we care?
Yeah, okay.
Then you have Warren, she's got a plan, which is a sort of technocracy of it. And then Bernie, you have Not Me, Us, right? I was watching this Toni Morrison interview with Charlie Rose from 1993 because I'm going to be doing some Toni Morrison stuff on Literary Hangover.
Fantastic.
For Jazz. Good.
By the way, well done plug. That's how you do a plug. It's called native content.
So in that spirit... we're going to go over to this Jason Miles interview.
Which is so embarrassing because I make the exact same point about the slogans.
I realized that when this was playing again. I mean, it just means it's a good point. It's true. It's from the heart. we're going to go over this Jason Miles interview. And at the end, we have a really great clip from Michael there. We'll come back very briefly for a quick gem segment. And then we're going to be joined by our good friends, Nando Villa, Wozni Lambre, Danny Bessner, Gene Bajelon, Ben Burgess, and we're going to tell more stories and hang out. We'll be looking at the chat, hanging out with everybody. You get access to that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Really hope to see y'all there. And yeah, enjoy this conversation with Jason. Welcome back, everybody. Left Reckoning. David here, as always, joined by Matt Leck. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, David. Sweating my ass off, I must say. But that's the only time I'll mention it.
You could not complain to me about heat, friend. It's like 107 outside. It's 82 degrees inside my house right now. And it's like, it's bad when you walk inside and you're like, oh, it's so nice and cool. It's like 84 degrees. No,
it's 72 outside. It's very 60 something inside. The sun is shining. I'm going to go stare at the ocean and think about why my life doesn't suck when I'm
there. I might need to abscond soon. But as much as I'd love to just have you on to talk about the weather, we're joined by our good friend Jason Miles. Jason Miles is a writer, a musician, and one of the hosts of the excellent This Is Revolution podcast. Thanks so much, Jason, for joining.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to be here. I love you guys like play cousins, and Pascal and I talk about it all the time. You guys have a great program that we actually watch and learn something from. And I do love the Marvel universe of Left podcasters, where we all get to spin around on each other's shows. And, you know, you were recently on Barnes' show, and, you know, I was mad at Derek because I think he might have got the better of you. So I was like, you know, fuck you, Barnes.
I had fun.
Just kidding.
No, and speaking on that, pretty soon, we'll maybe announce it a little bit later, but there's going to be more frequent collaboration between Left Reckoning and This Is Revolution coming up in August. But
yeah, let's wait. Have you ever heard of Jetsons Meet the Flintstones?
Well, who is who there? Are we the Flintstones? Well,
can I ask you guys this?
Mm-hmm.
To the Left Reckoning patrons and any of This Revolution fans, my birthday, I decided I'm going to add a movie night. We do a more educational movie night. Pascal usually picks the movie. I've been picking the last two movies. They're not that educational, and the one I'm picking is not educational. But for my birthday, I'm going to start adding a fun movie night. And if you guys are around, August 19th, I turn 45.
Wow.
And I would love to watch with a bunch of people I know and don't know, Ninja 3, The Domination.
Sounds fun.
Ninjas, a little bit of The Exorcist, and a little bit of Flashdance. So
wow,
all that in one movie is a recipe for fun, and I would love to share that with the Left Reckoning patrons.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just a couple of quick shout-outs, too. People should definitely check out Jason's piece in Sublation, Rodney King, The L.A. Riots, and The Perils of Police Reform. It's a really excellent piece. But today we're here actually to talk about a video essay that you can also find on the This Is Revolution channel called We Don't Need Another Hero. And Jason, maybe to just sort of kick this off, why do we not need another hero?
I was dicking around on social media, and from that police reform piece, which was months in the works, there was a lot of different chapters in my brain and a lot of conversations I had with Ture Reid, Pascal Robert, and Cedric Johnson about this idea of hero worship. And what I'm constantly seeing on this still very young left that we have, I don't really put the start date like a lot of people during Occupy, because I think that was such a different time. And socialism was still a bad word. So where you might have had people that were teetering on socialism or even maybe been socialist, you had also had a ton of anarchists, anti-vaxxers.
Ron Paul boys were there too, man.
Ron Paul was actually still a thing at that time.
Yeah.
My little brother wanted to vote for Ron Paul. And so there's an idea that I have this thing. I was also reading the Alpha Bunga Bunga book again. the end of the end of history. And there is a marriage we still have to the idea of bourgeois liberal democracy and representative bourgeois liberal democracy. And that if we get the right technocratic solution or right technocrat in office, then great things will happen. And Bernie Sanders, in my opinion, was one of the first people in a long time on the political spectrum, Bernie and Trump, to kind of break kayfabe. Political.
Could you explain kayfabe that for folks who might not?
Kayfabe is like pro wrestling. So it's the idea that we never tell you that this is fake. We never tell you this is scripted. When I say my name is Jammin' Jason Johnson, mm-hmm. and I got hoes in every area code, you don't know that I have a wife and kids behind, and I'm a quiet man, and we're all friends. It's the illusion. Mm-hmm. And I feel that those two guys did an awesome job at breaking the illusion, but Donald Trump, much like the person he learned from, Vince McMahon in wrestling, when how the sausage was made was shown in pro wrestling, he doubled down on the Mr. McMahon character, much like Trump building more walls, very nice people, kind of mm-hmm. doubled down all his rhetoric. But if you really look at how he governed, A, he was very incompetent, unlike Vince McMahon, but B, did anything get more messed up than it was under Reagan, Nixon, insert Bush Jr., insert Republican administration here. But even with Trump and Sanders, people had this fascination that one of those guys was going to fix all of their problems, which is fascinating to me because we also know that it's all kayfabe. It's all fake, but still we want to find a representative. And I started thinking about, because I also saw this in the world that we exist in doing left media. And what I find interesting is that there's people that kind of base their worldview on a show. Mm. I like Jimmy Dore. Jimmy Dore says this, ergo I say this and believe this because he's telling the truth. He's going to lead us all to the truth. Okay. I saw something similar in the apolitical 80s with figures like Morton Downey Jr. Mm. I know I'm a little older than you guys, and I'm sure you guys don't remember Morton Downey Jr., but I believe I opened up the show with some clips of him. And talk shows. And talk shows during this time actually started taking out game shows and soap operas that weren't doing very well. And Morton Downey Jr. actually had a nighttime talk show, and it was actually based out of somewhere in New York or New Jersey. But he grew up a Democrat, actually knew the Kennedy family very well. Hmm. Came from money. His dad was a performer, Downey Sr. He tried, didn't make it. But when he did his show, you could say faux populism, but he was to the far right of people like Ron Paul when Ron Paul would come on his show. And he would have left figures, but this is still the era where left figures are looked at as kind of washed out hippies that are overly idealistic. And he would even be to the right of Republican figures on his show, but young people loved it because he was their hero. Hmm. But his show lasted actually a very, very short time. And then he was kind of replaced with Jerry Springer after a little bit.
Yeah. And like, I think that, you know, for people who haven't seen it, there'll be a link below for people to watch the essay. Like, you know, one of the things that you're really building off of in this video essay is like a media criticism, and how it's not just like, oh, well, this figure came about at this time. It's reflective of the world around them. And the Jerry Springer bit that you make the argument that, like, you can't untangle this from Bill Clinton's war on poor people.
Mm-hmm. It's beautifully.
And you know what? We're going to have to do something
aligned.
We're going to have to do something, Jason. Just like I'm having this experience now, too, where it's like some of our younger audience might not know who Jerry Springer is. So we might need to let them know what that program was about, too.
Jerry, I think if you know Jerry Springer now, you might look at it as cliche. But you have to remember at this time, we're not used to seeing fights on stage. When Geraldo had the fight on his stage, that was a legitimate fight. But that started to become part of the shows. Let me get kind of a bit of a right-wing black figure, a black nationalist, i.e. Roy Innes. He made the rounds during this time. And let me get a legitimate Klan member, Nazi, in one of the Metzgers. I think maybe dad was in jail or something at the time, so the son was making the rounds. And those guys are going to fight. They're going to fight. And they're not fighting over anything ideological if you ever listen to the shows. It was just name calling.
Mm-hmm.
So now racism is just name calling. And racism is the end all be all problem, right? It's not poor people. It's not public goods governance. It's not cutting back of these programs. That was never part of the conversation. It was always the savagery of white people. And black people are tired of the savagery of white people until, you know, kind of like Rodney King, and the conversations changed a little bit. But there's still this need for people to have a hero to get behind, to believe in, because we're not talking about people having their own power. Mm. And as I was putting the show together, or the documentary together, I knew I wanted to end with that clip of Michael Brooks in the time he got to speak with Cornel West.
Mm-hmm.
I've never got to speak with Cornel West. There's a few things Pascal and I have been able to do. There's a few things I've done in my life outside of podcasting where I go, holy shit, my life's dope and I do dope shit. And I know when Michael did that, or I believe in my soul when he did that, he probably came back with, holy shit, my life's dope.
I can vouch for that. Yeah. I'll just say. And we'll play a little bit from that that you cited in the video later too.
Right, because he got a chance on this stage to not only share thoughts with people that he appreciated, but he got to really share this main thought that I think you guys were really getting into more in the show, which was the idea that systems are the problem, not people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the hero worship gets really bad, because you're looking for, you said this to me a long time ago, David, you're like, you're kind of setting yourself up for fascism. It was a conversation you and I had before I even had Pascal on the show. When you first met me, we were talking something about Jordan Peterson that has always stuck in my head. Right?
Huh.
And so this idea, this people-powered idea that you guys kept talking about, you know, I felt we have to get back to. But a problem with that, and here's almost a contradictory rub, is that sadly that man passed away. And when you pass away too soon, you become a martyr. Maybe that's not what you're looking for, because you want to remind people that before you went, the goal was that we have this power. Mm-hmm. Don't look for another me to help you, right?
Especially when, like, yeah, going back to like what you were saying, like the lessons in the argument really was about, you know, smashing down that feeling of, you know, if only we have the right guy in the right place. And I think that a lot of leftists in our movement are pretty good with that in other contexts. But even with the Bernie movement, I remember like the Not Me, Us, you know, slogan, which was a phenomenal slogan. Everybody would hear it and they would say, Not Me, Us. It's like, that's a great slogan. And like, Bernie cares about us. And it's like, no, Bernie was making the argument. It's like, if I get in power, I'm going to need y'all to do a lot of stuff to make this happen, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, again, like the messaging was great in coming up with that in the first place, but I do think there was a bit of a disconnect between that. It wasn't just like Bernie acknowledging you in the same way that, you know, when you're a famous musician, you say, thanks to the fans, because I wouldn't be here without the fans. You know, he's literally saying like, no, like if I become president, I'm going to need y'all to be organizing and doing street actions and pressuring politicians to make sure that we can overcome this system. And like, I think it becomes really clear when you compare that moment to some of the darker times, like in the 90s and in the 2000s that you do in that clip. I mean, sorry, in that essay. Because like the point is with Jerry Springer is like Jerry Springer is happening out of war on poor people. Jerry Springer brings up people who are sort of eccentric and like have bad behavior or something like that to be like, see, those are the poor people we're talking about. So even if you are a poor person who is being targeted by Bill Clinton, there is that like separation that's like, oh, that war's not on me because like I pay my child support and I don't smack people on live television, right?
I'm not trans. Yeah. I mean, all that shit is part of Jerry Springer. And the thing about when I say Sanders and Trump break kayfabe, Sanders, this is the first time we're hearing a politician seriously running for a big office like president talk about the power of we. Mm-hmm. And what's frightening to me and why I do these video essays and why I love doing cross streams with you guys, why I read all these damn books, is because we live in a hyper-commodified society where when there is good ideas and good sloganeering that we think is going to build a movement, it then gets modified before we know it. I was just reading an article in Business Insider that kind of effed my head up about the fact that people are getting terrorized because they have two-letter Twitter handles. And I don't know if you guys know this, there's a secondary market for Instagram and Twitter handles if you got on early on when Twitter and Instagram debuted in South by in the early aughts. A lot of these people worked in tech. They're like, oh, sure, the name's, you know, DG.
Yeah.
At DG. Right. Well, at DG means you've been around since the beginning. You're an old, you're a true dude, this OG. So if you become an influencer and buy your followers, you can buy engagement. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean likes, I mean literal comments. You can make it look like with DG at DG, you've been around forever. So what you say is the truth. DG sells for tens of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And these people didn't want to get off their handle. They thought it was a joke. And a few of them got swatted.
Jesus.
So living in this hyper commodified world where you and I, we see that slogan as this is it. We're going to go build off this. And there's not as much building as we would like to see. There's people that are like, well, I'm going to take this and use this for my campaign. If it fails or not, I just came up on all this campaign funding dough. Most of it didn't even come in from my district. Mm-hmm. It's a scary time. And I appreciated the always sobering analysis of the trifecta of Leck, Griscom, and Brooks.
Yeah, you know, I there's a couple of things there. One is how much Bernie's slogan there just contrasted with like Hillary, which was ready for Hillary, or Elizabeth Warren's was she has a plan. It's like they couldn't have been more like wrong. Like what are we doing here, right? But the other thing I wanted to just circle back to is, you know, you talk about this current influencer culture and how, you know, you still see things on TikTok that have like the form of information, and to trace that back to the closer to the source, how you do with how these shows develop. Like as a media studies graduate, like that, I really found that interesting because talk shows to me, like Maury Povich or Springer, were like when I would be home from school, like fake and sick, and it was like a window into like adultness, and it seemed like. That's like I'm getting an adult education now, and it was more interesting to find like the early bit of that was newsmen or journalists, and so you brought like the form and sort of condition people, because one thing that I always try to remind people is like corporations that are involved in news business, they're selling you the feeling that you're informed. And that's what they don't want to break. They don't like what informs you. That's too philosophical of a question for anybody who's in those executive offices. They want you to feel like you're being informed, and like how that has been weaponized against people and how they can understand the world. And like you said, and we can get to a little bit how that played hand in hand with tough on crime stuff or blaming people for their poverty. It's scary how like natural that seemed to come about? Like, I'm curious, at the time, did you recognize like how this was sliding?
If you think about, and I do this a little bit more on the last video essay that's out now about police violence, throughout the 80s, or when I grew up, and I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area in a city called Richmond, California, which was really, really violent. People always want to talk about the crack epidemic. I was there. It was scary. My younger brother's first memory is of me grabbing him and sitting over him because some kids that ran a crack house, and I say kids because we were all about the same age. I was like 12 at the time. We're trying to shoot a stop sign, kitty corner, and they didn't realize that bullets don't stop. They really didn't realize it. They're kids. So we're getting shot at. That's his first memory. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't remember, thank God, when he was learning how to walk and the drive-bys would happen and we'd have to grab him. You know, he'd get on my skateboard and grab him and pull him down. That was reality. So what is the news? The news is going to double down on that. But another reality, especially for people in Southern California, not so much from where I'm from, is police brutality. They were raising houses in L.A. You know, Rodney King is what you saw.
Mm.
If you watch the movie Panther, the first one that came out in 95, they actually talk about a cat that got killed in my city in Richmond, California. And the scene where they're protesting is, you see my mom's house by the police station. And there's a reality that the police violence never stopped, right? The Panthers are a reaction to a reactionary police force. Gangs necessarily aren't their reaction to a reactionary police force. That's a whole other conversation. But the talk shows definitely went in hard before Rodney King on this idea that the inmates are running the asylum and there's nothing we can do about it. And what made it more different than we see today is that the conversation was, well, we just need to give out tougher sentences. People like Ishmael Reed were saying things like, you need to give a 13-year-old drug dealer a life sentence. You wouldn't hear mm-hmm. those things today. But as I say this, June 20th, the year of our Lord, 2022, Chase Aboudin gets booted out of office, and he has aversion programs. So people of Latin descent don't get deported. So people are getting thrown in jail for property crimes, what we call quality of life crimes. So the difference is, if you really want to have some sort of like comparison between the times, is there was a menacing fear of young colored people shooting up the neighborhood. The music didn't help. As a fan of it, that shit didn't make it better. It literally gave them the poster to be like, see? And that's what you saw over and over again until Rodney King. And after Rodney King, the conversation changed drastically to the overzealousness of police. And then you get, you know, the Boys in the Hood movies after that that bring it back to Moynihan.
How conspiratorial do you get when you think about how conscious the media makers are in these sorts of curating these sorts of messages? I remember being a little bit paranoid after Trump won and Taylor Swift comes out with a song called "Look What You Made Me Do." I'm like, this is very on the nose. Like, I don't know. Like, and I'm probably being ridiculous when I say like they're actually like Lear Cohen or whoever it is getting together saying we need these messages of violence and whatever sort of suits us in this media. Or do you think it's like, I get the Chomsky method of like the certain messages get selected. I'm just curious how you think about those things.
As someone that sat in quite a few rooms when it comes to like major festivals, picking talent, I've been around it. It has more to do with money than it has right. to do with like
That's scary too. Like how reliable like this stuff? Because you talk about like the crime stuff in the '90s, but then you have like Sam Harris in the 2000s. Like it's just basically like doing the legwork for why am I thinking about it should be okay to torture Muslims now? Oh, you know, right? Like it just it's crazy how it's how reliable that sentiment is and media is.
Well, I mean, look. Music ain't changed that much. Cats are still rapping about being cartel members and drug kingpins. What's happening to them now? They're getting hit with RICO charges if they're really serious. Mm-hmm. These cats ain't really serious. A lot of them. And as someone that did numbers, they don't really do numbers like you think. First of all, their fan base can't drink. Venues don't like that. So there's a reason why you don't see the little, you know, gumdrop, whatever the fuck their name is, headlining stuff like Coachella. You're always going to see more established bands that bring older people because they need drinkers and established older bands, actually, or groups. You know, the numbers we saw during Beyonce were record-breaking.
Mm.
They fell off drastically the next year, like 20% drop in numbers. Yeah. So, you know, nostalgia really does sell. I don't really buy into the whole conspiratorial aspect of it because I saw Warren G, Snoop Dogg, and E-40, all guys that are in their 50s. You know, turn the party out and almost shut down certain areas of a festival because people were losing their minds. Old motherfuckers was losing their minds, right? The Froze booth at Bottle Rock went crazy with those guys. So they get more of those people. You want more of this. Why is Metallica still selling out arenas in their, you know, as a fan of the group, they look almost like grandmas at this point, but they're still selling out. Rolling Stones.
I mean, I think you're definitely on it about, like, the fact that like the music hasn't changed in the sense that like, you know, if they were trying to make the argument, for example, in like the '90s and stuff, that there's a one-to-one because music is so violent now that this is why things are getting bad. I think that's right. A really good point to make that it's like, that hasn't actually really, changed, but like, I think that this hits on a point that, you know, you make in the video too, where it's like, this is exactly what happens when you look at society, and society is big, it's confusing, and it's scary, and you try to deal with and absorb all of that information on a personal, individual, psychological level, right? So it's like, there's violence because the kids are getting too much violence, you know, in their media, yeah. Right? Or like, you know, we need to be coming at, you know, social programs in this country because this person didn't pay the mother of their child enough in child support, right? Like it becomes all this kind of individual stuff. And I think it's really encapsulated when you bring it back to politics where, you know, Bush after 9/11 is saying they hate us for our freedoms. And you notice like it's not imperialism. It's not all these other big structural issues. It's a personal, individual, psychological thing where people are sitting somewhere else seething. And like, it's obviously BS, but the reason that it pops up in the '80s and in the '90s and in the 2000s and today is that it's very easy, I think, especially if you've been enculturated and educated in the United States for so long, to think about things on that level. So it's like the message and the package is going to change for the times because people are just, I think you're also right that it's like, it's not that the media is like, oh, we're going to get them and we're going to come up with this kind of thing. They're just people trying to think who are stupid, you know what I mean? And they're going to go for the quickest version of it that they can come up with that right. Seems like some sort of grand narrative and present that as the answer. And it really gets back like to what I think is like the focus and the thesis of the video essay, which is like, that is a dynamic that is really bad for analysis and very useful for people in power.
It protects kayfabe. If I can, I want to tell you guys a quick anecdote, a true story that just recently happened to me. If I have time.
Yep. Go for it.
Okay. I went to a high school outside of Berkeley, California called Albany High. Sports was not very big in my high school. It wasn't a performing arts or anything special high school. It was a regular high school. It's just that where it was located, there's a lot of ex-hippies kids. I literally went to school with Country Joe McDonald's son.
a lot of ex-hippies kids, right? A lot of ex-Panthers kids. It was a very interesting high school. So we didn't have a lot of sports rallies, if at all. I don't remember one. We definitely had Multicultural Day. And remember, 44, this is in the 90s. There wasn't a term called woke. We had multiple clubs for the LGBTQ. It's very different high school mm-hmm. I went to, I think. And so at the end of Multicultural Day, a guy I knew who was actually always very nice to me in school, a white gentleman. Always, he was always really helpful when I first came there. I was very lost. I can remember I come from a totally different world. We had computer science together, and I would be stuck, and he'd always try to teach us and show up. Nice guy. Had his issues like most kids in high school do, trying to figure out who the fuck you are, and he kind of mm-hmm. found that if he was brash and offensive, which was the style of the times. Howard Stern is the thing. Radio DJs at this time are very mean. Comedy's really mean. We are the kids that grew up with Sam Kinison and Andrew Dice Clay. At the end of Multicultural Day, the whole school walks out. No, it also was a small school. It walks out of the auditorium, and he says something along the lines of, why don't we ever have a White People History Day? Got punched, and then probably about, I'm not trying to be over exaggerated, maybe 20 people beat the shit out of him.
Jesus.
Beat the shit out of him. He hit me up 2 nights ago. He's been watching the show, surprisingly.
Wow.
And he says, "Hey, Jason, you remember when the whole school jumped me?" I said, "Yeah, I don't like to bring it up." And we've talked off and on throughout the year. And he lives in Austria now. Doing very well for himself. And he's been hitting me up because he hit me up like 2 weeks ago. And he goes, "Jason, how do we get these kids to read more Adolf Reed, man?" So anyway, sorry. He hits me up and he's telling me about what he can remember. They beat him unconscious. I mean, I thought they killed him. And He says the reason why he got mad was because one of the speakers during our Multicultural Day was on some race reductionist, Europeans have ruined Latin culture kind of shit. And he didn't appreciate that. He wanted to say something about it. It was dumb. He regrets it to this day. But ultimately, he reminds me of what he can remember of the story. And he says that after that happened, the San Francisco Chronicle ran an article on him and said that he yelled out white power and did a Nazi salute.
Oh, wow.
After that article ran, someone got his phone number. Again, this is before the internet. You're just in the book. Mm-hmm. They had his name. He was a minor. He was in the book. They called him, and someone said, good job. We don't want these wetbacks in our town.
Jesus, yeah.
He screamed and hung up the phone, and he tells me, he goes, "Jason, how do we educate these young people on Marx? Because I believe in the U.S., we need socialism more than ever now."
Yeah.
It's a true story.
No, and it's wild. Like,
I don't know, not to get too misty-eyed about this kind of stuff, but like, I think it's a very helpful thing that there's a lot of options and information out there for people who want to get, you know, introduced to, you know, some of the ideas from Marx, some of the teachings from Adolf Reed, Michael Cornell West, right? Because it'll make a better world, and two, because those monsters on the other side, like, are organized. You know what I mean? Like, somebody goes out of their way to, like, call a young person after a story like that. Mm-hmm. You know, they're there, and it's really important. And I think it's been a really beneficial thing over the past few years that we've been able to build a very visible kind of network out there for people to, like, learn other things. Because the right has always sort of been waiting in the shadows for something like that to give you a book or a pamphlet or a phone call or whatever.
Oh, well, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's wild just the models you're talking about, though, that sort of like led him to that. Like Sam Kinison, you mentioned, like those kinds of guys. Like, I mean, I may be lucky that I based my sort of when I was looking for a personality and as like a sophomore in high school, I started watching the UK Office, and I'm like, I'll just be Tim. I'll be like a quiet guy. quiet guy that's secretly ambitious, but like, make just like funny comments on the side, and that's how you get the girl. You don't have to be like, yeah, like what's
you've
the other
nailed
guy?
The gym. You've nailed the gym.
He ends his story
and he says Jason, I and if you don't believe me, I can show you guys the message. He says, Jason, I moved to a more socialist country and I see the benefit. And I think that when we were in school, when you and I were in school, we never learned about Reconstruction. We never learned about these socialist movements. And because we never learned about this, he goes, dude, I went to visit Lenin. My kids learned this in school.
Oh, wow.
And he's upset. People at my high school to this day still think that he's this horrible racist man that, you know, wanted to kill all Negroes. And it was further from the truth, but I found it fascinating that once you see that a better world exists, you come back to, you know, where you're from, and you're like, well, we can change this. And even now, to some of his peers, he's a bit of a weirdo.
Yeah, I mean that's a fascinating little bit, and like I think the we there is important. Like, we can change this. Jason, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. People should check out This Is Revolution. We'll have a link below for people to watch the video. Since this is the 2-year anniversary of Michael's passing, I figured it'd be worthwhile to share this clip that you have put in your video of Michael when he was speaking with Cornel West. Just before we go to, is there anything that you might want to say on it or share with us?
I do want to say this, and I'm sure you guys don't remember this. If you do, I would call both of you dirty liars. In 2019, I think there was some sort of call-in or message-in segment for your patron. And I was on tour, and we were supposed to play Brooklyn. And I think you guys would have people come by the studio over here and there if they were from out of town. And I was really stoked to everybody wants to call me all of a sudden. So weird. I hit a message. I was like, hey, I'm going to be in Brooklyn. And Michael was like, Jason, give me back, message me with your information, and I'll give you the studio address. So I was all stoked. We had planned that we were going to go to Brooklyn to go meet you guys. I was like talking about y'all in the van, and then last minute the headliner switched the show and we moved to Manhattan. And my drummer, who's from New York, goes, "Ain't no way in the world the motherfuckers is coming to visit us in Manhattan if they're living in Brooklyn, man. Fuck that." So I missed out on hanging out with you guys in 2019.
Oh wow! No, that's fascinating. I did not know that.
But I mean, we'll just have to make good in the future, brother. Thank you so much. We're going to play this to close you out, but talk to you soon, friend.
Thank you. Peace out.
See you, Jason.
I just want to add that thank you, and it's an immense honor to be here, including definitely with Dr. West, who is an influence on me. And one of the major reasons that he's an influence on me is because of that synthesis and the ability to hold multiple truths, that we have to have some sense of a capacity here to do something with democracy, and then also not lie and deceive ourselves about what we are and what capitalism is and what empire is. I came across a speech fragment from Martin Luther King Jr. recently, which I played on my show, and I don't know where or the title of the speech, but I thought it was so important because we've put a lot of work, and we still have to put work into reminding everybody that the man was on the left. He wasn't a guy who came out once a year and said everybody should treat each other nicely. He was a serious... But the other thing that I loved about this speech, which was he talked about the fallacy that certain Christians misunderstood love as a ceding of power. And then Nietzsche came along and rejected Christian morality because he thought it was denying someone's vitality, the will to power in a healthy sense. And he said, love without power is sentimental and anemic, and power without love is abusive and corrosive. I'm paraphrasing. And that was when I saw it, I thought, well, here, okay, we know the left-wing Dr. King. Well, here's the Machiavellian Dr. King, and I love it. I want the left to have Machiavelli so that we can have the strategy, the ruthlessness, the clarity to actually win these battles and be ruthless with institutions. And then I want us to learn how to be really kind to each other, welcoming of a broad set, and actually have a movement that has the capacity to do that. That's why the cancel stuff is relevant that Katie brought up, because it's a stand-in for this eliminationism of other humans, which is neoliberalism enacted. And it's also a contradiction from when we get utopian. It's beautiful. We're the people who sit around and we say, how do we have a world where there's no prisons? Okay. That's a radical fucking statement. That's a real thing, and we should take it seriously. But then, on the other hand, oh, well, these people could never be part of a coalition because they made a mistake or said something. Like, it's a contradiction in what we're enacting. So what I get that I hope is in the realm of answering your question from this Dr. King clip was left-wing, spiritual, but also with a vision of power. And if we can synthesize those things, I think we will speak to the highest impulses of this country. We will be welcoming to people, and we will win.
Yeah, man. I mean, one, thank you so much, Jason, for coming on. And two, like, that Machiavelli stuff was, like, consuming him at that point. He was talking about that a lot. And, you know, Michael and I were working on a book together that we just sort of started kicking off as the pandemic started. And he was talking my ear off about it, and I followed, I will be honest, about like 20% of it, and I really wish I could have seen where that was going, because he definitely saw something very, very important there that I would love to be able to dive into.
Yeah, I was on a Mike Racine's new show in memory of Mike yesterday, I think it was, maybe it was today, but talking about, you know, I'm an uncle now, I met my niece, and she learned to walk out in Montana, but feeling a little bit older, a little bit. And it, actually, I'm at the age now when I met Michael. Michael was this age. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think, like, what a 40-year-old Michael would have been like, what Michael would have been like in his 40s, right? Like, and it sucks to be robbed of that. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I think it would have been a lot of that sort of stuff. Yeah, I remember I was reading a book on Machiavelli and Dante, and we talked a little bit about it. And that was what drew me to Michael, was his curiosity. Was and when people would say the word passionate, and it's like, he was passionate about, you know, those sorts of things, and that's really what it took. Like, I think he would react a little bit skittishly to some people saying like he was irreplaceable and that sort of stuff, because I think like this sort of thing is, if you're motivated enough to do this, you can get there. Now, the tough thing is not everybody has the luxury of like getting a day job doing something like this where they can comment on politics in front of a widespread audience. And it's capitalism. It's a structure of capitalism that limits not you yourselves. And I haven't really, like, I always see those comments and I understand that they come from a good place, and I feel it too. right. But I also think like some kind of duty to push a little bit against them.
I very much agree. Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk very soon with Ben Burgess, Gene Bajelon, Wasni Lambre, Nando Villa, Danny Bessner, about some of those memories. I just, you know, just want to say, like, you know, I miss so much, but like some things that I'd really like to be able to hang out with him again is sitting at a bar. So we just go to these quiet places and, you know, just talk for hours. Michael wasn't a very big drinker, but he'd hang out for like 3-4 hours.
Yeah, he liked to see, yeah, he did. The drink tea was a secondary for him. Yeah.
No, hang out with him and his girlfriend, who is just such a wonderful person and delight. And it was always fun seeing them together too. Because she was probably the only person who, like, Michael was a very, like, you know, stand on his own 2 feet kind of guy. She was the only person who could sort of be like, Michael, you need to do this or that.
With the eye roll. Yeah.
It was pretty sweet. We'll have some more time to share memories in just a moment. Remember, you get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. All those folks really excited to share with them. We're going to do this a little bit quicker because we're going a little over. But I figured, you know, in the spirit of revisiting things, that it might be worthwhile to bring up the gem tonight, because there's a story here that I think is very worthwhile and important for us to sort of get into. Understanding the world around us, not so much out of sympathy for the rich and powerful, but just sort of understanding the movements that are happening in capital right now so that we can be better prepared to react. And what am I talking about? Times are not good. Not good for Silicon Valley finance. In 2020 alone, over 30 fintech companies launched in the United States. And what is fintech? Fintech is a product, undoubtedly, of an era of cheap money. What do I mean by cheap money? When interest rates, which are effectively set by the Federal Reserve, are really low, it becomes very cheap to borrow money, which allows you to sort of fuel companies with lots of capital. But it's always sort of reliant on this fact that money for the investors initially is very cheap for them to acquire. And again, remembering the kind of two-tiered system that we live in this country, you know, monetary policy affects us all, but it affects us very differently. When monetary policy is extremely lax, the rich and powerful get incredible opportunities to find ways for them to make a buck. For us, it means that you have, you know, these kind of inflationary pressures, right? Things like, think about like when we talk about rental markets in this country and how BlackRock was able to go around the country and buy up houses in the past few years, despite the fact that housing prices were extremely high. They were able to sort of get access to this because they made a calculation that, you know, the interest rates are low enough for us that we will make money on the other side of this as prices go up on our investments. So that's what, you know, kind of loose monetary policy creates. Now for us, when the interest rates go up, that means your car payment goes up. That means your all the credit card loans that you have go up, and it becomes harder and harder for you to get access to capital, right? So it's a two-tiered system in the sense that while money was cheap, it's not like we were really living through the benefits of that. But as a monetary policy is sort of tightening, as the Federal Reserve raises rates, that means that we are the first people on the chopping block to be hit. So fintech really is a product of cheap money. And again, what do I mean by fintech? Financial technology services. So tech companies that are trying to ride this wave of speculation and cheap money to provide services like small loans to consumers. Maybe to make this really clear to people, because there's a lot of things in the tech industry, it's usually smoke and mirrors bullshit. They're like, oh, we have a computer, it's a tech company. Think about companies like Affirm, right? Which basically floats you $300 so that you can buy you know, a coffee machine or something like that and pay that off over the period of a year. Highly speculative, highly risky endeavor, and also obviously also highly predatory on people. Or also companies like Robinhood is another fintech company. And there's plenty of others who found a way to sit on things that are either outlawed in general, right? Like a lot of the Bitcoin stuff that we saw crash recently, or ways that they can sort of ride this wave of financial speculation you know, providing loans and things like that to people because money is cheap, and sort of tying it to an app or something. And then people are like, well, this is different, instead of just being increasingly speculative and dangerous activity happened by a few folks. But what we're seeing right now is that industry is suffering from a few things. One, lack of profits, right? And there's always going to be a promise of some profits, but a lot of these companies like Uber, for example, you know, one of those things is just, we all know this story by now, you know, Twitter, all these, Amazon, for example, at the early stages, they don't make money. But now because the monetary system is tightening, people are starting to look, you know, a little bit deeper and seeing, oh, wow, this is a very shoddy business model. Or, oh, Lord in heaven, this is an outright scandal and an illegal operation that, you know, we don't want to be invested in. So as all of these, you know, the lack of profits, some of the examination of these companies have smashed this previously growing industry as investors are worrying that at the end of the era of cheap money and tightening is going to mean a hurt to their returns of investment in these companies. A Financial Times analysis found that shares in fintech have fallen an average of 50% since the beginning of 2022. And if you compare this to what was happening in the industry in 2021, because so many people were locked at home and buying things. This really led to significant growth. And for a lot of these companies, on average, they were growing at something like 1,000% revenue growth in a year, which is massive. And remember that it's not just like the new kids on the block. Even companies like PayPal are getting hit by the system. Another example, a private company, right? So it's not public, but Klarna, they've been hit too. They slashed their valuation from earlier this year at $46 billion to $7 billion. So fintech is being hit hard by the era of cheap money that allow these things to profit and to be attractive to investors. And really bring in a lot of people into their schemes and scams. Like we've done big, breakdowns, for example, of Robinhood, but also these kind of small time loan companies are extremely predatory as well, because they're sort of sitting for people who don't have access to credit in the form of like a credit card, right? Which again, is not an angelic industry either. But they're finding the people who are sort of left out of that and charging them 30% interest rate on small payments, right? Which is just a way to sort of prey upon the unequal system that we're living in, right? But that's how capital goes. And the point here is that we're seeing this huge shedding, and Lord in heaven, I skipped over like the headline here. Fintech as an industry has lost $500 billion this year in valuation, which is not a small amount of money, $500 billion. So this is a very significant shift. And I wanted to talk about a little bit just to remind folks that this is just the tip of the spear. These companies have always been overvalued. And if you read financial press, while you would hear people who would push it, you know, those old guys in bow ties would say, hey, the fundamentals of these companies are very, very shoddy. And people should be worried that if the economic system ever changes or the economic calculations ever change, that these companies would be the first ones to signal a significant reduction in economic growth. We got to be worried about what is going to happen as debt starts to be collected. Because as much as inflation is a crisis, and it certainly is, inflation hits working people far harder than it does rich people. Remember, I talked about this yesterday, when they're looking at the New York Times just came out with a big survey, and the rich voters, they don't list the economy as a priority. It's not too surprising. And it's poor working class voters, and particularly working class voters of color, who are saying that this is a big threat. And the reason I bring that up is because you hear all this stuff about inflation, and certainly inflation will, you know, annoy some rich folks. But it's much, much more of a pressing issue for people like us. But I also hate to be the bearer of bad news. We should also be paying attention to this systematic crisis in debt, and that's the global debt crisis. So total global debt this year, 352% of gross domestic product in the first quarter of this year. And the private sector debt is accounting for 2/3 of this. I know a lot of people have been very predispositioned to hearing any kind of conversations about debt and sort of, you know, turning their head and ignoring it. And don't get me wrong, like a lot of the austerity stuff that you get from the right is nonsensical. But you also have to remember that all of these systems, from the private industry to governments, have been relying on the access to cheap money. And it's extremely worrying when the private sector is set up in a way that they are reliant on cheap, cheap, cheap money. This is a decades-long business strategy, not just in the United States, but across Europe and a lot of developing countries as well. And it can have disastrous consequences. Financial Times also estimates that 17% of companies in industrialized economies are quote-unquote zombies, or entities that can only be kept alive by virtue of low rates. And remember what we mean there, only be kept alive by virtue of rates. And that means for the other 80% or so of companies, it also means that they are relying on debt as well, but the threat is not so big that it will completely collapse them. But a lot of these companies that we've seen sort of rise up in the past few years have been reliant on this access to cheap capital. And as the monetary system is shifting, the likelihood of one immediate consequences of people losing their jobs. We saw that with everyone's least favorite boy, Elon Musk, moving people from across the country to Austin, Texas, and then laying off 10% of his workforce. And remember, that company is not a car company. That is a speculation company. So it's not surprising that they were hit harder and earlier than Toyota or Ford or GM. But this kind of belt tightening is coming. And if we thought that the conversation about unemployment and inflation were bad, just wait till rich people and investors start saying, we need to start seeing much more significant returns on our investment when companies do not have access to cheap capital to kind of placate this class of people. This is, you know, I don't have the answer necessarily other than the big things that we talk about, a complete reorganization of this system so that we aren't beholden to debt speculators and dangerous people like Elon Musk with our livelihood. But these are the kind of things that I think it's really crucial that socialists be paying attention to, because there is significant movement right now happening in the capital sphere, and capital and politics are intertwined. And it's not going to be surprising as we start to revive the zombie of austerity politics in the next few years to deal with the debt crisis that has been looming for years. And not to be all like, I told you so. But I remember in like one of the early gems that I did on TMBS talking about the debt crisis and saying, this is a huge exposure where if this policy ever changes, we're going to see very, very severe consequences for working people. And a lot of folks said, well, we can always borrow more. But the problem is, as the interest rates go up, that decision becomes harder and harder and harder to make for people who just want to make as much money as possible, as quickly as possible. And we really need to be prepared for this new era that we're entering into.
What do you think, like, the solutions are to this? Like, it's, you know, we talk about, like, if Bernie gets in, but the economy looks shitty, right? You're sitting on top of a bomb that isn't easy to defuse. Like, is there, what might people look toward?
One thing, in addition to, like, overcoming the court, one thing that has to happen is we need to, the Federal Reserve is already politicized. People say it's depoliticized. That's bullshit. It's politicized in favor of the rich. And we need to push back against this idea that, oh, it just operates outside of politics, because one, it doesn't. And two, it's extremely dangerous. So we need central bank policy that works for everyday people and doesn't start to push, you know, quickly harsh austerity on people in the form of high interest rates. Remember, too, that, like, you know, people talk about the Volcker shock a lot, where Paul Volcker, who was Fed chair, pushed up the interest rates very, very high, you know, one of the largest increases in history. And it had tremendous effects here. But also remember that all these countries around the world, they get debt from the United States, which meant that their payments went up significantly. And then who shows up to save the day? World Bank and the IMF. And what do? Privatize your industry, mass spoils of the commons, right? Like, these are the kind of things that have significant effects for Americans and people all around the world. And the idea that these are outside of politics is complete bullshit. You know, like, fixing the economy as a whole is a big task. And I'm not going to sit here and say I'm going to do it in a 5-minute clip. But, like, the first step has to be the ability to inject a people-focused politics into the institutions that have the power to affect as much as they do.
Yeah. So, for instance, like, during the financial crisis, you don't just bail out banks. You might.
No, I mean, well, you know, Mark Blythe said something I thought that was really good, actually, in our Michael Brooks Legacy series, when we had Richard Wolff, Ben Burgess, and Mark Blythe on a show. And I was interviewing them, and Mark Blythe said, you know, one thing you have to remember about the Fed policy during the financial, during the COVID crisis, is the taps only go one way, because they were only built to go one way, right? Like, they were only built to prop up and send money, to folks. I mean, like, we've talked about some things that the Federal Reserve could be doing. For example, like, the Federal Reserve in COVID bought a shitload of corporate debt, right? To make sure the stock prices were stable. Well, what if the Federal Reserve was directly giving money at zero to negative interest rates to cities and localities to buy crumbling housing, to buy large buildings, to buy trailer parks, all these kind of places that people live in, and transfer that ownership into either public ownership or owned by the tenants there? Right? Like, there are things that could be done with a financial institution of that much power and leverage. But the thing is, like, it works very, very quickly in favor of the rich and powerful because it's designed to. And as Mark Blythe said, yeah, the taps go one way, and we need to be building different kind of taps.
Yeah.
Well, y'all, We got really fun stuff coming up. I think we'll be quick to hop over there. We're going to be going to the post game. Going to be joined by Ben Burgess, Danny Bessner, Gene Bajelon, Wozni Lambre, and Nando Villa. I think they're already waiting for us. So you can get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. I would really appreciate the support. And, you know, I'll just say in closing to the public audience, I really appreciate everybody showing up. I mean, the tragedy that we've all sort of been through together has been horrifying, and it's really tough. And I miss Michael very much. Mm-hmm. And having this community and all the folks around us and knowing that we're not in it alone, that we can continue this work and most importantly, this spirit means a tremendous amount to me. So thank you all.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.